Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Appreciate you tuning in today. Today on the show, we have the one and only, our very own Tony Yazbek, founder of the Bitcoin Way. This was an unbelievable conversation. If you've ever heard Tony's story, you've never heard it like this. I can positively assure you of that. We dive into what happened in Lebanon, Tony's reaction, how he rebuilt his life, and the mission that he is on now to bring Bitcoin and self-custody, freedom money as it was designed, to the masses. I think you're going to love this episode. Hey, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Tony here. Tony, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here with you.
Man, I'm looking forward to this conversation. I think probably anyone listening knows that we work together. The only reason I'm at the Bitcoin Way podcast and doing this whole thing is because of you. But I think this is going to be a fun conversation. This is round two. We had some issues when we tried recording in person, but hopefully this time we make it through. So I sort of want to start at the beginning, because you and I have talked about a lot of the things that we're going to discuss today, but I think probably many people have heard some of your story, parts of your story, and I love the origins. So you were on like some early forums with cypherpunk types, like when you were a teenager, like a young kid. I'd love for you to share how that came about. Like, how did you find these people in these places? And obviously you don't even know any or most of them. And what was your experience, you know, engaging with these sorts of folks?
Yeah, man, this was very, very early days when the internet first, you know, came about. We were still working, you know, with dial-up modems. You know, I don't know if you recall these, the 14.4K modems, you know, then upgraded 20.8K modems and all that fun stuff. and when the internet came about, I was just like drawn to it. Like, I honestly can't explain how it all began, but it was just a fascination and attraction, which my parents find very unusual, considering that no one in our family tree, you know, has any tech skills whatsoever, let alone a typewriter. And so all of a sudden, you know, here comes along, you know, little Tony, who's, you know, spending countless hours on a computer doing God knows what, and like no one would understand what on earth I was possibly doing. But I was just fascinated with everything pertaining to the internet, and I just random researching about anything and everything I can possibly think of just to sit on a computer. And then I remember one day I came across like an article or some video clip of some sort, you know, about some hacker who did something. You know, it's like, wow, shit, you know, this is really cool stuff. How do we get into this? And, you know, diving deeper into this, eventually found my way into what they called back then IRC, Internet Relay Chats. And these are just really like hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of just random chat rooms about anything and everything. And I would post in just anyone I would, you know, find myself allowed to enter. Can anyone teach me how to hack? You know, like this was literally my sentence. You know, just like this random stranger posting these, copy pasting this all over the place. And everybody ignored me in the beginning until at some point somebody replied. And they're like, what kind of hacking do you want to do? You know, like all sarcastically. And this is how the conversation started. And I was like, you know, just anything. I just want to learn this stuff. And, you know, they toy with you at first, you know, and they're like, yeah, they don't take you too seriously. But then, you know, I understood this stuff very quickly, even at a very young age. Like, I mean, they would say things, you know, assuming that I just like disappear and go away, never come back. But I'd respond, you know, intelligently, you know, to their surprise. And that's how the conversation grew. Like the more they shot at me, the more I responded, the more engaging the conversations became. And you know, after many months, it took about maybe a year almost, I got an invitation to a room. I forget what it's called, but it was some bizarrely named, you know, cypherpunkish type room with a whole bunch of people there. And it was constant communication about doing this and doing that. A language I had, wow, I had no idea what was going on. Nothing I could comprehend. But I knew these guys were doing some like really crazy shit, like very cool things. And after you spend enough time there and you talk and, you know, they ignore you at first again, you know, and eventually they get to know you, you know, like, and you start to engage a bit more with them. And they test you. This is how it starts. They test you to see, are you like a serious person or someone who's going to be wasting their time? And luckily, I was one of those people that understood things very quickly. So whenever they used to ask me to do something, I would do it like almost instantly and reply back. And after a while, they forgot that I was this like nobody who came out of nowhere and just happened to be in the group. And we just got engaged into this thing. And this is where I discovered this whole new world of cypherpunks, like the real people that control the world. It's these guys. Okay. It's not those clowns that you hear about on the media and you like, you know, the ones that post their videos on TikTok doing all sorts of funny business. These are the guys that you never hear about. These are the guys that build their own hardware and write their own software. This is why they're undetectable. And so the type of things that they would do would just blow your mind. I mean, I remember I was like 13 years old and they had me build my own router from software, right? Like now, when you talk about a router, you walk into a store, you buy it, you plug it, and you have internet connections, right? Well, back then, you didn't really have them. You had to build them. And so the hardware wasn't readily available to everyone. So these guys figured out how to share an internet connection via software, which was illegal at the time. You know, when you had the internet, you had to pay per computer. You had one subscription. And so I'm like, what do you mean you can share the internet? Like, yeah, you can share the internet. How do you do this? You know, so they sent me the instructions and I did it. I'm like, holy shit, because we had three computers at the house, but only one of them had the internet. I had to keep removing the modem, plugging it into the other one, you know, whenever I wanted to use it on another machine. And so when I learned this, I tried it. And all of a sudden, all three computers had internet. Man, back then, that was like unheard of. And so I was so excited. I ran up and I was calling my parents down like, hey, come down, come check out what I did. And they came down and I told my dad, do you have internet on this computer? He's like, no, we don't, because we're only paying it for that one. I'm like, just sit and try to go somewhere. So he goes, sits on the computer, and he types in some website and it loads. And he freaks out. He's like, what did you do? And I'm like, try the other computer. Now, does it work? And he gets up, you know, like he still has this puzzled look on his face. And he sits on the other machine and he tries it. And it also fucking works. And he's like, what did you do? So I explained to him what I did. He understood absolutely nothing. And he's like, is this legal? Are you going to jail like next week? I'm like, nobody's going to jail. But you see, based on that one incident, this is when I knew like this was my thing, man. And so for the next countless years, I was involved with these guys learning about things that, you know, I can't really talk about here, because to this day, they're readily used by those that know about them, right? And the knowledge that you pick up in on forums like this, no one will teach you this, like no one. And when I got a bit older and saw what the university IT program was like, I'm like, what is this utter garbage? Like, I'll teach you things you've never heard of. So, you know, I dismissed it completely. It was a complete and utter joke. And I just like sheltered myself in this world, learning as much as possible, living in this world. Until one day I realized, you know, that I could make money off of this, because my days, you know, were being spent, you know, learning and hacking and doing all these hobby projects, but for free, which was driving my parents crazy. My dad, especially, he's like, when are you going to get out of this basement and go get a job and do something useful? I'm like, you know, but this is extremely useful. He's like, I don't see you doing anything useful other than, you know, sitting in front of a screen all day. And so that caused a bit of a, you know, a bit of a conflict growing up, because he understood nothing. And I couldn't find a way to make him understand that what I was doing was really, really valuable. He just wanted to see the money coming in because of it, right? And so he started taking random jobs, you know, things I didn't necessarily like, just to keep him quiet and make him happy. But I never lasted in any of them, because 2 days in, I was like bored out of my mind. Then I just quit. And, you know, that was a problem. And then you fast forward until I met my, you know, girlfriend at the time, and she happened to be working at an insurance agency. And one day she calls me up. She's like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm on a computer. I'm like, what are you up to? She's like, well, we just got a quote from this network guy who came here, who wants to redo our entire network and build a database for us, you know, for clients and whatever, and all that fun stuff. I'm like, okay, that's cool. And how much is he charging you for this? And she mentioned some silly number, some ridiculous number, like about $60,000 back then when I was like 16 years old. I'm like, $60,000? The hell is he doing for $60,000? And how long does he need? And so she explains, you know, basic net database network, set up the network, make sure it's secure and all that fun stuff. I'm like, but I can do this. She's like, what do you mean? I'm like, I can do this. And I'm like, yeah, and probably for less than what he's charging you. She's like, are you serious? I'm like, yeah, I'm dead serious. Tell your boss, I'll come and speak to her. So she's like, okay, I'll tell her. You know, I thought she was kidding. But half an hour later, she calls me. She's like, all right, tomorrow, 9 a.m., come to our office. I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm like, my boss, she said yes. I'm like, oh, shit, all right. Well, she actually took me seriously. I'm like, okay. So I went, I met the boss, understood everything that she had, she wanted. I told her, all right, all of this, give me like three to 4 weeks, I'll have it done. And she's like, well, how much you want for it? She didn't know that I knew that the original quote was $60,000 for about like 5 or 6 months, you know, time frame. I'm like, I don't know, give me like 30K, 28K. I can't remember exactly what I quoted. I just quoted a random number just like that. I'm like, I need 3-4 weeks. So she's looking at me like I'm completely nuts. I'm like, look, what do you have to lose? If I don't deliver, you pay nothing. It's free. Worst case, I just wasted your time for 1 hour this morning. That's it. So she's like, well, you know, okay, go ahead. 2.5 weeks, it was done. All right. I went there. The only trouble with what I had done were a few spelling mistakes. She was blown away. She's like, how did you do this in 2.5 weeks? And I've been interviewing several companies, you know, that do this, you know, as a business. And they quoted me some ridiculous amount for 5-6 months. I'm like, well, you know. And she stayed with that program, that setup, for 11 years. And how do I know this? It's because my dad was a client of hers. And so whenever she used to send him the invoice to renew his payments, it was the invoice that I had created, the template that I had created. So she was still using that system for over 11 years. So imagine a $28,000 investment over 11 years was nothing. It's for free for her, right? And that's so this crazy. Is what, so when I came home with that $28,000 check, again, my mom was like, what? Where did you steal this from? You know, it was like surreal. And this is when it clicked. I'm like, everything I know, I assumed everybody knew. Turns out nobody knows anything. And so that's when I got in. I'm like, you know what? This is a good business to be in. I do this for fun anyhow. Might as well get paid. So I got into tech and started my first venture, entrepreneurship, so to speak, into software development, you know, with a friend of mine that I met online. We were building software, really, really cool stuff, selling very, very well. Then dove into consulting and then, you know, ventured, you know, as I got a bit older and built more like credibility just because of the age. You know, most people don't take you seriously when you're like a 21-year-old kid and you're telling them, you know, I'm going to charge you $100,000 to do this and that. Even though I could do it, they don't believe you and they don't give you the time of day to prove yourself, right? So I would come in at 22 years old. I'm like, yeah, it's going to cost you 100-150K for 10 days work. They're like, this guy is on drugs, you know, and then they would dismiss me. They wouldn't talk to me. So it took a bit of time to build that credibility. So I was kept myself busy doing, you know, software development and other things where the age wasn't really a factor, where a lot of it was online. So there was no physical interaction anyhow. And this is what led me into the world of cybersecurity and eventually, you know, built, you know, a massive consulting company, helping businesses and individuals, you know, structure themselves and protect themselves online. And took it from there, man. It was, it happened really, really fast. Once it started going, things really escalated quickly in a very good way. Until it all blew up in Lebanon.
Yeah, we'll get to that. I'm curious. So I go a lot of ways with this. Back to like those chat rooms. Do you think this is just a matter of curiosity for me? Do you think you were ever interacting with like CIA or intelligence agencies? Were they like sniffing around at that time, or was it so new that like they didn't know that was even under their purview?
You know, that's a very good question. In the moment, I never really thought about it much. I only started thinking about this like much, much later, I'm like, holy shit, maybe I was talking to some FBI agent or CIA agent. But even if I was, they were very helpful in my my journey, in my knowledge. Like, I mean, even if they were, they were providing a lot of useful information to help me learn all of this stuff. So in hindsight, I'm like, even if they were, who cares? Like, they weren't like nefarious about it, you know, like they weren't like on a mission to arrest one, because they were involved in, if it was actually them, they were involved in that whole scheme to begin with. But I don't think so. But a lot of the stuff that was being created would really blow your mind. Like, I mean, I can tell you some stories offline about things that, you know, like you think, no way, man, no way. You can read about some of these more popular hackers. You know, I don't know if I mentioned to you, Kevin Mitnick. This guy's a legend, man. You can't hand this guy an electric toothbrush, because somehow he'll figure out a way to hack it to make money or steal money from somewhere. That's that's how good he was. And he was put in jail several times, and he was forbidden from touching anything that had a pulse. that's how good he was. And a lot of these people that were in these forums were of that caliber, you know, but they weren't the type of people that you would hear about. Like, they weren't those flashy, yeah, look at me, what I did type of folks. Not a freaking word. You'd be walking past them in the street, you wouldn't have a clue about who they were. That's how good they were. And I remember one of them told me way back when, he goes, "He who owns the keyboard runs the world." And that stayed with me since then. And it's true to this day. You know, those that run the world are the ones that dominate the computer world, the networks. Because if you take control over them, you own everything. And most of these networks that are implemented worldwide are complete rubbish, because they're run by people that don't have that level of skill set, because that's what it takes to protect data and intellectual property, you know, the right way. And it costs money, because guys of that caliber, you're not going to get them at $13 an hour, right?
Right.
You're gonna get them at a much higher rate. And so a lot of places either can't afford to pay them or just don't want to pay them. And so they make do with whatever they know. You know, they get their cousin or some guy, you know, at a lower rate to do the work that's good enough. And everything's okay until it's not. And this is what we're starting to see now, right?
Yeah. Yeah. What was your favorite company that you ran? Or like, was there a specific line of service within the consulting realm that you did that you were like, this is what I really, really love doing, the service I most want to provide?
I loved all of the ventures that I was involved in, because they involved people, and I'm a people's person. I love interacting with folks. I love helping people, especially in the tech world. You know, when you see somebody's reaction, like their face light up, it's like, holy shit, how did you do that? You know, that for me is priceless. And there were countless situations like this where we were able to genuinely help folks, you know, solve problems that they've been struggling with for weeks, sometimes months. Businesses that were run in ways that are absolutely horrific, you know, and they had spent years throwing money at companies that couldn't fix the problem. It was just like patching the problem, but since they didn't know any better, they couldn't really detect that it was just a waste of time and money, until someone like myself came along and overhauled the whole thing in 10 days. So when a company spent years throwing money and the problem is still there, and then you have someone come in and fix it and make it disappear in 10 days, you know, like, it hits you like a ton of bricks. Like, what just happened? So some people may argue from a business perspective, it was stupid for me to do this, because, you know, there's no repeat business. But I'm not in the business. I was never in the business to lie or defraud people or swindle people just for the sake of recurring business. This is not who I am. I don't enjoy doing this. And in fact, it gets boring for me. If I have to keep pretending to repeat the same thing just for the sake of making money, I can't do it. It'll drive me crazy. I'll quit. So we weren't in this business. Like, I wasn't in the business of doing this. A lot of other companies were and still are doing this. They say, why do you fix this thing? Never fix, like the common code, never fix something 100%. Why? Well, because then you kill your revenue stream. I mean, I guess it's true. You know, if something stays broken, somebody's going to keep paying you to fix it. And as long as you never really fix it, you keep making money. But that's dishonest. I don't believe in that model at all. And especially when it comes in the tech world, that's very dangerous. Because now you're screwing around with, you know, what could potentially be critical information that can affect people's lives in a, you know, in a serious way. And so this wasn't what we were about. And eventually, you know, people understood that if you wanted things done right, they would contact me or my team or my company. And that was the approach that that we took. And we did this with everything, whether it was software development. Like, there's a very purist mindset that I take with all of this stuff. I can't do things halfway. I just can't. If I'm gonna engage with you on a project, it has to be done flawlessly. I can't take a shortcut or cut corners just to make you happy or meet your budget. If you want something done right and you can't afford it, then I will tell you, wait until you can afford it, then we'll do it. Because if we do it your way, something's going to break along the way. You're not going to be happy. You're going to come and, you know, give me a headache. Nobody needs that. So do things right or just avoid them until you can do it right. Always ends on a happy note. That's always been my philosophy since the very beginning. That's how I was raised. That's how I was taught, you know, in these forums. Never take a shortcut with any of this stuff. Sure, things cost money, but when it's done right, it's done right.
Yeah. And I imagine too, at the time, you probably weren't being engaged by like an internal technology team. Like people were still figuring this out. So much of tech was outsourced then. It wasn't like, you know, today you've got a CIO and a director of information technology and, you know, at a big company, you know, maybe, you know, hundreds or thousands of people who know something, who can help make informed purchases. I feel like the early days of the internet, I need routers set up. I need, you know, and like, I like kind of your point of your first sale that you closed, they had no idea, was $60,000 a good deal? Should they work with this person? And then how long should it take? So that companies then were incentivized to take longer, charge more, because there wasn't like the transparency of what things cost that we probably take for granted now, I would imagine.
Yeah, of course, there was a lot of deceit in the tech world, because most people don't understand technology. To this day, most people don't understand technology. It scares them because it's so virtual, like you can't touch it. A lot of people still have a hard time wrapping their heads around this, which is what makes it, it's an opportunity for those that do get it. The tech world, in my opinion, for me, I think it's a gift. You know, like sometimes when you have a chef, he can make a Michelin star meal out of leftovers in the fridge, because that's just, he looks at the food that's left and he knows what to do with it almost magically, right? It's an art, it's a gift. You can't learn this. It's either you have it or you don't. Same thing applicable to any field, whether it's an artist or a chef or an engineer. Some people are just really talented. Steve Jobs was a visionary, right? So he didn't, some of the products that he made weren't new, but somehow he saw them in a way that was different, that changed the world. That's the eye, that's the vision that I'm referring to. When it comes to the tech world, I have this. I can walk into almost any place, and this is what we did. We'd walk into any company. We've never met them before, just with an iPhone. And within 5 minutes of them starting to talk, I'd already understand everything they wanted to do before they finished the conversation. And I already had the solution in mind for them. So I would just stay quiet until they finish, just to be polite. And then by the end of it, boom, listed all out, in and out. Rock solid discipline, efficiency, done. And so word of mouth got out, you know, like you used to, All the business that I got growing up and all this was all, I'd say 99% of it was word of mouth. I did zero advertising, and I didn't have to advertise, because at one point it got so crazy busy that I was stretched out between actually doing the work and finding people to help me, because I'm just one guy. And at some point, you know, like as automated as I can make myself, there's only so many hours in a day. And so, but to find the right team, that's also a challenge, because there's a lot of folks that say, yeah, yeah, I can do a whole bunch of things. But then when I ask, when I question them, they can't do anything. And so I can't have someone that's just, whatever, good enough. Good enough is not good enough. You have to be good. Or if you're not good, you have to have the ability to become good. Because if I was always looking for someone like myself, I'd never find it. I'd still be looking. So I stopped doing that. I was looking for people that had the potential to learn what I was teaching them so that they could be useful to me. And that, my friend, is a very, very long process. And I adopt the same mentality here at the Bitcoin Way. No one that comes in the Bitcoin Way is just landing from the moon. You know, whenever, like, we get a lot of requests, I want to be involved in the Bitcoin space. I want to help. I want to do it. Great. Your intentions are impeccable. Kudos for that. We respect it. But to do what we do, you have to meet a whole roster of, you know, very specific criteria. And if you don't have them, it's not because you're a bad person. It's just you don't meet the qualifications required to do this the way it's intended, right? Because now you're not just dealing with tech. Now it involves money. So there can't be an oops, you know, I didn't know moment. You can't have that. Everything needs to be done perfectly every single time. And so this discipline has to start up here. Like, you have to be wired to work that way. It can't be like, I have to do all these things. If that's how you think, you will never succeed in the tech world. When we get up to go to work, since the beginning of time, it was like going to a party. You know, like my days would start at 5 a.m. since the age of 19 and would end whenever they end. Like, I haven't worn a watch in God knows how many years. I never wear a watch. One, because if you want to have a good time, you don't keep time, you don't look at the clock, right? And it's stressful. It's 5 o'clock, it's 6 o'clock. Who cares? When it's done, it's done. When I'm free, I'm free. That's how it worked. So, and that's the approach that, you know, we took, that I took, you know, for many, many years, you know, being involved in all sorts of things in the tech world, be it software, being cybersecurity, being networking, being troubleshooting. At one point, I was Apple's right-hand man, you know, when it came to setting up businesses with Apple products, you know, because they knew that we had the team. If they called me at midnight to go somewhere the next morning at 8 a.m., we could do it because we'd be in, boom, 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 out. No fuss, no mess, no time wasted. This is the type of efficiency that I believe is required to do things properly.
Yeah, and you've brought your mindset to Bitcoin, and it's, you know, as someone who was a client before working for the Bitcoin Way, it was evident to me that it was systematized. It's a process. You've done it a million times, and you get people very comfortable quickly. Well, what's been fun for me to see now, engaging with partners, engaging with clients, and talking to people who are about to begin the process or have gone through the processes, it's like everyone's experience is identical, you know, and it's like that uniformity that I think gives people so much confidence. It's like, oh, there are a lot of people who are doing what I'm doing. And almost by definition, there's probably someone who's not as smart as me or who hasn't been around as long as me who has figured this out. I can do this, you know? So hats off to you. So, okay, I'm going to fast forward and maybe sort of fill in some blanks for people. So you're in your 40s, you've run some successful businesses, you're, heading toward an early retirement. And then Lebanon, 2019, everything changed. Why don't you tell the story? Maybe sort of frame it for people, like what happened in Lebanon, and then what was your experience waking up the day that everything hit the fan?
Lebanon, that horror story that will haunt me till the day I die. That was a mistake. that I will never forget. It was a day I decided I'm going to take a break. I never take a break. You know, like since forever, I was always like the workaholic because the work was fun. And one day I decided, you know what? Maybe I should just chill out and go enjoy life and, you know, have a good time. That was the mistake. Because this is what led me to just keep the money in that bank, because, you know, that's what you're taught since the day you're born, that, you know, you go, you do your work, you do good work in the world, you're successful, you put your money in the bank, and you live happily ever after. And so I believed that bullshit, because what other option did I have? You know, my parents told me this, their parents told them this. It was just how things were. And for a while, things were great, man. I mean, yeah, I was retired. Thankfully, you know, I was financially very comfortable, you know, self-made. At times, I got very bored because really, like, I missed the action. For me, it wasn't really about the money. Like, it never really was about the money, even back then. Yes, the money was great. The success, you know, pays for itself. But it was more about the reaction, the results, the interaction with people, you know, making people happy, making people smile, changing, impacting people's lives in a positive way. This was the money for me, right? It wasn't the actual money. But because it paid well, you know, there were a lot of things that you can, you know, give yourself, a lot of toys, like I like to call them. So yeah, I was enjoying the toys. So I had a lifestyle, you know, of nice cars, you know, going out, traveling, hotels, you know. Very, very nice, nicely structured. And it's very easy to get comfortable in that lifestyle, but not in a good way. When you get comfortable, you know, that's when things start to fall apart. And because you stop focusing as much because things are just chill. And that's what happened. You know, that's really what happened. I was just enjoying life. Until one day, literally one day, I went to bed and I woke up the next morning and I heard that, you know, the banks aren't working anymore. And like the credit cards don't work anymore and, you know, there's no more money. What the fuck do you mean there's no more money? Like I'd just woken up with my cup of coffee and that's the first thing I hear. No more money. Like, what are you, crazy? So I call the bank. There's no, nobody picks up the phone. All right, so maybe it's early. I'll wait it out. A few hours later, call the bank again. Still no answer. Then I'm like, okay, let me go see what's happening at this bank. Go to the bank. There's like a million people outside trying to bust down that fucking bank, yelling and screaming, a whole disaster of a scenario. I know the manager at the bank. You know, like when you're an important client, one thing about the banking system in Lebanon is that they treat you like VIP. Anything you need, they bring for you. Anything at all. And so the bank manager, I knew her personally. She used to call me regularly. I used to call her regularly. Hey, what's up? What's going on? You know, what's the latest? What can we do? Blah, blah, all that stuff. All of a sudden, she's gone. The fuck is she? Call her phone, nobody's there. Call her house, nobody's there. Calling everywhere, nobody's there. I'm like, let me try this card. So I go, I try my card. Nothing, error, decline, nothing. Nothing's working. So, you know, in the moment, I don't know, man. Like, I mean, it was a feeling that I've never experienced before. You know, it's like... It's like a cold sweat that just, you know, hits you from head to toe and your heart sinks. And you're like, could this be real? For real? Nothing's working. No more money. And so later on during the day, it was confirmed. You know, it was announced. The banks have seized everybody's funds. No one has access to anything. Everything is super restricted. And if you could withdraw something, like if you had, I don't know, like $1 million in the bank, they would restrict you to like maybe $400 a month of withdrawals. Can you imagine? So, what do you think I felt in that moment?
I can't even imagine.
I don't know how to describe how I felt. I was shaking. I remember I sat down and I was in a crazy cold sweat. I was shaking, literally shaking. I didn't know what to do. You know, like for the first time ever, my mind went completely blank and all of a sudden the whole world around me just disappeared. You know, I just saw myself like alone in the middle of, like, I couldn't see anything anymore. I was just, it was blank. And people came up to me laughing, what's wrong? You know, and when I told them what was wrong, you know, what do you expect their reactions to be? Like, all of a sudden, everything is a big deal. Things that are not, that you've never even thought of become a big deal. Like, you want to have a sandwich for lunch? That's a big deal, because how are you going to get it? Whatever food was in the kitchen was the only food you had. Once that runs out, where are you going to buy? How are you going to replenish that stock? You can't. There's no money. So the only way to do that is to go break into a supermarket and steal, which was exactly what was starting to happen, because everybody was locked out. It wasn't just me. And when you put people in a predicament like this that they've never experienced and nobody has ever prepared them either, they resort to whatever comes to their minds in order to get the result that they're looking for. Right?
Survival.
That chaos is a movie that I can promise you not even the best Hollywood director can make. It is not a movie anyone should watch. Yeah. Because you have people that you've known your whole life that are unrecognizable. And when I say unrecognizable, I mean like dangerously unrecognizable. So it's literally survival of the fittest. If you don't know how to fight and protect yourself, you will get killed. If you happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And what's worse is that it can come from someone you know. Not because they're bad people, it's because they've gone insane because of what just happened. So that mayhem, that chaos throws you in a very dark place. It took me almost a year to come out of this. And throughout this process, I wasn't even sure I would come out of it, or even if I wanted to come out of it. It was a horrific, horrific conflict, struggle, a mental fight to live or not to live. Because everything seemed impossible. Like there was no solution in sight, you understand? Everything was nuked. It's not like you had strings to grasp on. There was nothing, nothing. It's like somebody took a nuke and dropped it on your life and formatted everything. And you had nothing except for like plain ground in front of you. Nothing to hold on to. Nobody to call. Everybody I knew disappeared. What do you do?
Yeah. So, well, it's a good question. So, understandably, it took a lot of time. What did you do? So did you leave Lebanon as quickly as you could? Did you find work? I mean, what was like the next step to evade the chaos?
In order to deal for it with a situation like this, you have to take your pride and you have to take your ego and you have to make it disappear. Because right now, you need anything just to make it to the next hour. And when you've got people that depend on you, that amplifies that pressure, right? I don't know how I made it work. I did things I never thought I would do. I had to do them to survive. Like I said, you resort to whatever comes to your mind to make it. And a lot of people that I grew up with, that I know, aren't here today because of this. They couldn't make it. It was too much. So, reliving that horror story is very hard, because you are literally living minute to minute sometimes. That's how it feels. When somebody tells you, I'm hungry, what are we having for lunch? And you don't have an answer. How does that make you feel?
Yeah, I can't even imagine. I mean, I've got 3 kids. I can't imagine trying to explain it. And their whole lives have been, lives of wanting for nothing, right? You know, they've had any meal they've needed. And I can't imagine having to explain to them, you got to go hungry for a while.
And how do you explain to them that it's your fault, even though it's not your fault?
Yeah.
Right? You understand the conflict and the anguish and the pressure that something like this puts you through? And why the mental turmoil that it put me through is something I will never forget. And in fact, it's what keeps it. I make a point to never forget it, because it is what completely changed me. I had a decision to make, Michael. It's very easy. Either I quit and I'm no longer sitting here having this conversation with you, or I have to figure something out. If you want to know what you're truly made of, genuinely, genetically, at the fucking core of your DNA, what you're made of, a situation like this will give you that answer. Anything other than something like this, you think you know yourself, you don't know anything. Because until you're pushed to the bare metal of your existence, you have no idea who you are and what you're capable of. And this is when I learned who I was. That even under a situation like this, and even under the mental duress and the torture that it puts you through, somehow, minute by minute, I found the strength to stay up and keep fighting. Until we got to some point of comfort where I can actually focus on something. Because I went into a very deep depression, kept to myself. I didn't want to talk to anyone. Like when people would talk to me, it would be very dangerous, because it wouldn't take much to ignite, to say something to me that, the wrong way, and then we're going to end up in a big problem. Because my mindset was not in a good place. Like I was ready for anything. Completely emotionless, desensitized, ready for war. That's how angry I was. And that anger was not healthy. I knew it wasn't healthy, but I couldn't shake it. I couldn't get rid of it. It was so strong, because I needed an answer. And no one was giving me that fucking answer. So I had to go and rip away that answer, find it myself. And when you're doing this in a world of chaos and world of where people are completely ignoring you, it's like you have a 0.01% of finding that answer. And so this is why people give up. It's like, why bother? But if I had given up, this is what kept me going. Despite all of this shit, despite all of it all, if I had given up, what message would I leave to those that depend on me?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's right? A good question to ask.
What's the
yeah.
message did I leave? He was a loser. He gave up. He quit. After everything that I've accomplished my whole life, I'm going to leave that kind of legacy. But let me tell you, it took a year to come to terms with this. It's not something that was like a 5-minute decision. because the pain and the anguish destroys all sorts of common sense. You're not thinking straight. All you're thinking is rage and war and anger, which in fact is eating you inside. It's not hurting anybody else. It's just hurting you. But it's so strong that you can't shake it. After many months of somehow settling into some form of stability, I sat back in front of that computer. I didn't touch a fucking computer for many months. I didn't want to do anything. You understand? Like, my brain was completely gone at that point. Just, reclusive to myself. Don't want to talk, don't want to see, don't want to know anything. And then I sat down in front of a computer again, just, not looking for anything specific, just being on a computer, going online again, just to see what the hell is going on. And then they announced this bullshit COVID. Like, if things weren't already bad enough, now they come up with this shit where they lock down the whole world. So not only do they destroy the country financially, you go through a financial destruction. Now, on top of it, they invent this garbage where now they want to force you to believe that there's a life-threatening virus out there, and they lock down the world and all the garbage that came out of it. So imagine the compounding of these negative events. Okay, this is what I had to go through. It's like trying to climb Mount Everest in half an hour. How are you going to do it? Well, so when I tell you the journey is a very hard and painful one that I don't wish upon anyone, I genuinely mean it, because I don't think most people that have never experienced something like this will make it. And I understand why they don't make it, because it is impossible. At least that's what it looks, that feels like in the moment.
Yeah, and I think too that we've got, at least in most of the West, it's a culture that is so used to having things, and it's like, it's part of the reason we deal with so many of the nonsensical problems that we deal with, like the cultural issue. It's because we're so damn fortunate that we make up petty problems and causes, and and it's like we've become completely detached from the strength that I think humans should inherently have, because we're so damn comfortable. I can't imagine, in a place like the United States, something like this unfolds, the percentage of people who would just absolutely lose it, be completely unable to cope with anything going on. And I guess that might be a good transition into Bitcoin. And by the way, Tony, I've heard you on a lot of podcasts, and I don't think you've lingered on the subject of Lebanon that long and, been that personal. So I appreciate it, because I think I know it's not a fun story to relive, but I think it's an important one for people to understand, because nobody, no culture, no monetary system is immune to the same effects of the irresponsibility of politicians and central bankers that you experienced. And I think that transitions nicely into Bitcoin, because it's why you're here. This pushed you to not entirely brand new industry. We help with cybersecurity, and if you view Bitcoin as fundamentally a technology, which it is, and something that must be protected, it makes a lot of sense how you would end up here. But I think for you, the mission is much bigger than that, right? I mean, the mission is and central banks and state control of the money printer and, so many of the things that led to the demise of Lebanon. What was your, could you maybe just give like a quick background on how the Bitcoin Way came together, maybe a little bit about how you found Bitcoin. I think most people have heard Bitcoin origin stories a lot of times, but
yeah,
tell me a bit about the Bitcoin Way and how this all came together.
Well, it all started, after, my mind settled in and I decided I wanted to find answers to what happened. I had to find something that made sense to me. I wasn't accepting that this just happened out of nowhere. That's just how it is. And so I started diving deep, into down that rabbit hole, into searching for the answers to my questions. And I quickly found out that this whole disaster that took place in Lebanon was man-made. There were people responsible for it. It didn't just land from the sky. It was the governments, it was the corrupt politicians, it was these thieves behind the central banks, all of these people that were responsible for what happened in Lebanon. So there is a name behind the crime. It wasn't an invisible one. I found out who they were. And this is what led me deeper down the rabbit hole to understand that all this corruption wasn't isolated to Lebanon. This is an international crime ring, all tied, all belonging to the same fiat club, right? They're all part of that cartel. And so when I understood this, I was able to redirect my attention and my energy and my anger towards something more constructive. I was like, you know what? I can't go to war with these fuckers. So that's off the table. As much as I wanted to build an army and like annihilate them all, it's not an option. And it's not who I am either. By resorting to violence, you become just as bad as they are. So that was off the table. I had to find this more intelligent way to destroy them. And this is, all these questions eventually led to an Andreas Antonopoulos video where he spoke about Bitcoin for the first time. And that's when I understood that all of this garbage was possible because they control the money. So how do you destroy them? You strip the money away from them. You destroy the power of money. You remove it from their hands completely. And so how are you going to do this? Whoever this God-given gift to the world was, Satoshi Nakamoto, he gave us that answer. Bitcoin. But when I first learned about it, I think in the moment I was so emotional, I just jumped on it, like instantly. But then my cybersecurity brain came on, like, hold on a second. Before you get carried away and like find yourself in another disappointment, why don't you like research this a bit more and find out if it's true or just another bullshit scam? And that's when it really began, the research and the reading and the reading and the asking the questions and all that. And I realized that, fuck, if I can't blow this up, then let me ask somebody more intelligent. Maybe they have a way. But then I learned that governments have been trying to destroy it for years, and all of these losers also failed. So I'm like, if they, with all their resources, failed, what am I or any one individual going to do? It's not going to happen. And this was back then. Fast forward to today, where the whole decentralization of the Bitcoin network and strength is exponentially stronger, it's impossible. I dove down the white paper, I read it, and I watched videos, and I asked a lot of people to really understand and cement my understanding of this, to really see that it cannot be manipulated or corrupted or stopped. That was the key. I didn't want to give myself a false hope that this was going to, it's all great, but then some asshole out there is going to do or say something that's going to ruin it all. I had to be sure this wasn't possible before I invested even more of my time and energy into this. And when I realized that this was it, that's it, then it was almost like a resurgence of energy and hope that started flowing through my through my veins again. And for the first time, I think I smiled that day. You know, and people were looking at me, they're like, "Are you okay?" You know, because they hadn't seen a smile for like over a year. And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm okay. In fact, I'm more than okay. And this is why." And of course, nobody understood anything, but I didn't really care. I understood that this was real. And I took it from there. And I started reading and reading and asking and forming, you know, connections with people online, again, that I've never met because we were, you know, locked down back then, to learn more about this and, you know, chatting and conversing and, you know, engaging in more forums and more chat groups to learn the tech, how this all works. This was like in my playground now. Bitcoin is technology, right? Everybody talks about it on a philosophical, economic, financial level, that it's the best thing, great. But if the tech is not accounted for, all of this is for nothing, at least for those that don't respect the tech, right? Everything that you hear about Bitcoin is true. When Michael Saylor speaks and, you know, all these top guys that talk about the micro and the macroeconomics and all this fun stuff about Bitcoin, it's all good, it's all great. But what not so many people talk about is the engine powering all of this. If you're not doing Bitcoin properly, none of this good news matters. So the whole revolution, the whole premise behind Bitcoin is the whole self-custody aspect, right? Where for the first time in history, human beings can own their money, real money, not that shit printed by a bunch of thieves, that worthless toilet paper. That is something the world must completely forget about and ignore. But that's going to take time because, like myself, everybody else was brainwashed since the day they were born. And in some places, people still accept that garbage to buy stuff. So why would they stop using it? There's no real incentive, right? But that narrative is falling apart now. You know, that Ponzi has gone on for far too long. And now we've gotten to the point where that toilet paper literally is toilet paper because things have gotten so expensive because of the excessive money printing, which isn't going to stop anytime soon, by the way. And so as people realize that they can buy less and less things with it, they're going to start looking for options. It's not a light switch. It's going to be a process because that's just how human nature is. So anyhow, this is how I got into Bitcoin. And I started to do this on my own for a while, freelancing, you know, meeting people, talking to people everywhere, supermarkets, gas stations, whatever it may be, just engaging with random strangers. Hey, by the way, blah, blah, blah. Some people would like, yeah, whatever. But some people would listen. And those that listened were enough because, you know, I would charge for my time and all that stuff, obviously. And so it helped me get back on my feet slowly, you know, redoing basically what I've always done my whole life, but from zero, from ground zero, on my own, at my own pace, doing my own thing. And I did that for a while and everything was going great. I had somehow reestablished myself at a certain comfort level, nowhere near what they stole from me. But you very quickly realize, you know, when you lose everything that you don't need much to be happy. And so after a while, I forgot about all the money that they stole from me and all that lifestyle. That was left in the past. I never looked back on. I don't miss it even to this day. Like, I really don't miss it. That version of myself is dead, completely dead. But one thing that I learned is that when you die, that's when you're genuinely free. So Tony 2.0, this version that you're talking to right now, would not like version 1.0. Because version 1.0 was meaningless in many ways. Now, I see the world with a completely different lens. What has value to me now is nothing material. What has value to me now are things that are memorable experiences, interactions with people, helping others, you know, seeing people struggle and offering them a solution that, you know, brings them out of the struggle. This is what brings meaning to my life now. It's not about the money. My purpose here is not to be rich. Not anymore, anyhow. It used to be back then. Yeah, it's no hiding it. Now it's not about that. Now it's what makes me rich is my network of genuinely good people that I meet. And in the Bitcoin space, I am very blessed to meet some of the best people humanity has ever known. That's what keeps me going. And yeah. So after a while of freelancing, one day I was just contacted on Noster by Andy. You know, I just got a random message by a stranger. It's like, hey, noticed you would like, you know, we'd like to talk to you about whatever. And I'm like, who is this guy? Messaged me out of nowhere from Noster. I'm like, either it's a scam, but then again, Noster wasn't that popular. So whoever that was on Noster actually, you know, must know what he's doing, because to be on Noster, since it wasn't really known, you had to be somehow down that rabbit hole as well to a certain degree. And so I decided to entertain him and, you know, take the call. And we got onto a conversation and, you know, he mentioned that, you know, what his plans were and what he wanted to do, you know, and he was interested in getting into Bitcoin even more, you know, and helping others and all that. Anyhow, we aligned a lot on a lot of things. And he asked, you know, if I was willing to help, you know, them do this. And so I took a while to think it over, because I wasn't sure if I really wanted to, you know, go back down that road of my past life with a company and all that stuff. Like I found my peace now on my own, doing my own thing. And I was happy with it. But after a little while, you know, like I thought it over. And I'm like, if I really want to win, I need to have more people on my side. Like, we need to build an army of the populace, you know. And most people are not going to do this because they don't know technology. They don't come from this world and they find it daunting. But what they do know is that if they screw up, they're going to lose their money. So I need to find a way to remove that fear, so that they don't shy away from exploring and, you know, understanding Bitcoin, because they do need it. It is absolutely what 8 billion people need to regain any form of value and dignity in their lives, and to come out of this garbage modern slave system that we were thrust into. And so I accepted. And this is how the Bitcoin Way was formed. The mission at the Bitcoin Way, as everybody knows by now, is to fast track the onboarding of everyone, or as many people as possible, into Bitcoin, proper self-custody, by doing the tech precisely how it's intended to be done. No shortcuts, no workarounds, no bullshit, exactly as the white paper intended. And these are the services that we offer, as everyone, you know, clearly knows by now. But this was the premise behind it. In order to win, you need an army. And in order to get that army, you need to equip them with the education that they need to help themselves, because it's a collective effort. You need more of the world to get into Bitcoin, to opt out of this garbage money, to fast track the adoption of Bitcoin. And once that reaches a certain level, the legacy system dies on its own, because nobody's going to want it. And it's already happening in many places. People don't want fiat. Why would they take that garbage? It's worthless. But there's still a large percentage of the world that doesn't see it, but their turn is coming. Because what they do see is that their life is getting more expensive, whereas the life of someone living on a Bitcoin standard is getting less expensive, and in many cases, free. Right? So at some point, someone's going to want to switch sides to go, you know, where the grass is greener. But when that happens, depends on every individual. Pain is usually the biggest motivator. The way it changed me, it's likely going to change other people. I personally don't want to see that happen because I know that that pain, the amount of pain required to make someone take such a drastic decision is extreme. And a lot of people won't handle it, unfortunately. So we want to avoid this. We want to avoid people even have to experiencing that pain. And so we provide this knowledge. This is what the Bitcoin is about. It's about knowledge. It's education. We are neutral ground. We're not sponsored by anyone. Nobody pays us to say anything. We do our own research. We test our own products. We filter out the good from the bad. If somebody's saying something that's not right, we call them out. Neutral ground when it comes to the truth about Bitcoin, money, cybersecurity, the whole thing. This is the premise. This is the ethos, the values behind the Bitcoin way. This is who we are. This is what we're about. And this is what we're going to continue to do. Because like you said, this is a mission. It's a mission to educate. They tried to destroy my life. They failed. And now what they have is a big problem. Because they have turned me into a weapon of education that is going to take this knowledge and I'm going to spread it to 8 billion people if I can. Because everybody needs to know this and understand how to protect themselves and to never, ever let themselves be put in a position to be abused by a bunch of useless parasites, thieves, crooks, and criminals that believe they have the right to own the world and run the world the way they see fit. These people, that mold, must be destroyed and never, ever allowed to come back again. This is what I'm hoping Bitcoin will accomplish.
Well said. You've given me both one of the most impassioned and incredible podcast recordings that I think I've done. And you've also made it very difficult for me to figure out how to transition out of everything we've talked about into something a bit more light. So I'll shoot my shot here. So we are, let's see, we're sitting at a little over 106,000 per Bitcoin right now, Tony. And I know for us, things have just been getting crazy. I mean, people are beginning to appreciate the wealth that they have now stored in this new incredible asset, and they're trying to figure out how do I protect it properly. I'm curious what you envision, like if you were to pull out your crystal ball, next 12 to 18 months, what do you think we see in terms of Bitcoin adoption? How do you think the Bitcoin world, so to speak, or the world because of Bitcoin looks different end of 2025, say?
I think things are going to accelerate really quickly. I mean, a lot of attention now is being focused on Bitcoin, you know, for whatever reason, whether it's the reasons I like or approve of or not, it doesn't really matter. There's no such thing as bad advertising when it comes to Bitcoin. You've got, you know, ETFs that started the whole wave. You know, now people that dismissed Bitcoin all of a sudden take it seriously because someone like Larry Fink decided to say that it's a good thing. And now all of a sudden it has credibility. You see game theory on full steroids now. Governments are, you know, FOMOing into it, you know, talking about strategic reserves. Every day there's something that puts Bitcoin in the spotlight. But what's important to remember is that while all of this buzz around Bitcoin is good and it's definitely bullish, you shouldn't forget the fundamental of how Bitcoin was created for and how it's intended to be used, right? Bitcoin is peer-to-peer electronic cash. It's not custody your money with an ETF or an institution or engage the use of institutional help in a collaborative custody for the sake of security and, you know, protection and that illusion of all these things. That's not what it was designed for. These are all, I consider them gimmicks, you know, an extension of whatever, some legacy system using Bitcoin to offer a new service. Sure, some of these services are better than leaving money on an exchange, but you're just removing the risk from one place and putting it somewhere else. Bitcoin was never created for somebody else will take care of my money. Bitcoin was created for I take personal responsibility for my money. That's it. It's not an ETF. You don't custody it at a bank. You don't involve an institution to custody your money. You have to be insane to do this, because what are you doing? You're repeating the same stupid mistakes of leaving your money in a bank, but now you're using Bitcoin with somebody else to do it because you think they're good people or they have a good reputation and what have you, which may be true. It's not accusing people of being bad people or having bad intentions. It's just repeating the same bad habits. When people had money in a bank, five-star banks, were also reputable and great people, amazing people, but the bank still stole the money at the end of the day, right? So the concept of trusting someone with your money, that is what must be broken. That's a bad habit that you must completely destroy. You cannot do it, no matter how great they are. They may be the best people. If they're still connected to that corrupt system, they're playing by rules that they don't make and they can't control. So if they ever find themselves coerced or put in a position they don't like, they're not going to look out for you. They're going to look out for them first. And whatever happens to you, well, that's your problem at that point, right? Bitcoin was created to remove all of this. Remove all of this. Everyone can learn this. Bitcoin is about personal responsibility. It's not nuclear science. It's not an advanced physics course. It's a bunch of new steps that you have to learn, but you have to learn them. And it has to be done meticulously and comprehensively. No skipping steps. No one is too dumb to learn Bitcoin self-custody, even if you don't come from the tech world. There's plenty of resources online if you're the type that likes to experiment, great. If you want to take a shortcut and get things done the first time, there are people in the space that do this for a living, like us, for example. You can come to us. We will absolutely help you thoroughly from point A to point finish to bring you to a point of self-confidence where the amount of money that you're dealing with doesn't really matter. So whether you're dealing with $100 or $100 billion, it should be the same stress-free 60-second transaction in and out that you do on your own without anybody's assistance or permission. Yes, that's possible now with Bitcoin. In fact, that's why it was created. So stop believing the lies and the marketing and the hype that you need somebody's guiding hand because, you know, it's avoiding a single point of failure and all that other bullshit that is being, you know, falsely advertised. That's not true. If you lose your money, that's your problem, but that's how it's supposed to be. If you introduce somebody else into the formula and then something goes wrong, well, then it's your fault. Because you introduced that risk because you somehow thought you weren't capable of doing it, which is silly.
Yeah. Everyone can custody their Bitcoin. I mean, it's challenging, kind of like learning to type is challenging or learning to drive a car is challenging. But when you figure out how to do it and you piece it together and you practice and continue to improve, it becomes intuitive. Alrighty, let's wrap this up. So, question I ask everyone at the end of the show. This shouldn't be too hard for you. I don't know if you've thought of one though, but unpopular opinion that you hold, and you get bonus points if it's unpopular and it's going to piss off some Bitcoiners.
Yeah, most Bitcoin influencers are fiat people at the core.
It's a good one.
Yeah,
elaborate though. I know what you're talking about because we've discussed this before.
There are a lot of telltale signs, man. There are a lot of telltale signs. Some of the most obvious ones are those that, you know, talk about Bitcoin all day, since the best thing since sliced bread. But then, you know, you ask them, do you accept Bitcoin payments? They say no. And so why don't you accept Bitcoin payments? My accountant doesn't like it. You know, it's not good for my taxes. Why are you in Bitcoin in the first place? Right?
Yeah.
Or you've got these other people, they're like, yeah, Bitcoin, but here, give me all your KYC information. How does that fit into the Bitcoin ethos? Bitcoin is all about protecting your privacy as well, right? The whole premise of Bitcoin is that you don't have to give up your information because it's your right not to do so. But, you know, when Bitcoiners force you to do it in order to work with them, then are they really Bitcoiners? Or are they Bitcoiners with a foot in the fiat system, you know, trying to please both sides sort of thing? It's not the way it works. Pick a side. Either you're for the side of freedom and Bitcoin and, you know, money for the people, or you're not. That's the way I see it anyhow. People may disagree with me. That's fine. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion. But if you're pro-freedom, pro-Bitcoin and all that stuff, then do it properly and, you know, back it up by your actions. Live the life that proves that that's what you're about. Thankfully, there's a lot of people doing it. You know, we know a lot of people now that are living on a Bitcoin standard. They're extremely happy people. You know, like I don't hear any one of them complain about money anymore because their lives have gotten considerably better. And as the value of Bitcoin goes up, right, just ask yourself this. If you're not in full control of your money, are you really sleeping well at night knowing that somebody else holds a key to your funds?
It's a fair question. And I mean, if you look at, you know, divorce, stress, I mean, finances are always one of the top ones. And I think that's only exacerbated. And, you know, especially you have inflation peaking, you know, at 9% in the last year and a half. And it's like people still haven't pieced together exactly. They know something's amiss, but they aren't quite sure what. And I think that's the great awakening. But I mean, obviously, I completely agree with you. Like, to sit around and talk about Bitcoin as this monetary revolution, the peaceful revolution, we're going to end central banking, but I don't accept Bitcoin, this incredible form of money that I talk about all day long because my accountant says it complicates things. Like, that's wild. Like, you got to take a look in the mirror and get that sorted out. Some major cognitive dissonance going on.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I don't think people value their privacy as much as they should. That's why they're so accustomed to giving it up that they just do it on autopilot without necessarily thinking of the ramifications. What you have to remember now is that when you KYC with a company that's Bitcoin related, that's very different than when you KYC from something that's not Bitcoin related, simply because the value of that database is exponentially bigger when it's Bitcoin focused, right? I mean, KYC in general was never designed for anybody's protection. It's very clear by now that it's just a surveillance tool. But, you know, when you KYC yourself with companies because you have to, because they have to ask you, because, you know, they're still implicated in the legacy system, well, then, you know, your information is on a database that belongs to a very juicy honeypot. And what you don't know is how well that company is protecting that data. You have no control over this. Most of these people running these companies don't come from the tech world. So they're either outsourcing that service or maybe, I don't know, figuring out a way to do it themselves. You don't know, you just don't know. Even if they are the best people in the world, and I'm sure a lot of them are, and even if they have the best intentions, which I'm sure a lot of them do, if the information is not properly protected and it falls into the wrong hands, the result is the same. You still have a problem if your name and details are on that list. That is something that a lot of people need to really focus on, because it's not just, yeah, it'll never happen here. Can you imagine if one day, or when one day, something like Coinbase gets hacked?
It's going to be a crazy, crazy day.
You don't think it's going to happen because the ETFs are custodying their funds there? What, you think they're like some sort of God-given protection? That because they're there, no one's going to touch them? Those are precisely the type of places that people go after. They're not going to go after the one that has like five clients. They're going to go after the big honeypot. So do you trust companies like Coinbase with your data? Do you believe they have the skills to protect it properly? Like I said before, they have to get it right every single time when it comes to that protection. Someone on the outside just needs to get it right once. So the odds are against you. And doing cybersecurity is extremely expensive because guys that have the skill set that I'm referring to are expensive. They're not going to work for $15 an hour. They're not even going to look at you for $15 an hour. And those are the type of people that you need on your side. So unless you have a team like this that is on top of things and continuously improving that security model, because it's not a set it and forget it. You have to continuously keep up with the times and the improvements in the tech world. If you're not doing this, and I generally believe most companies aren't doing this, then it's a risk. Then it's not a question of if, it's just a question of when. Somebody decides, all right, well, they've accumulated, you know, $100 trillion worth of value now. Let's hit them. Boom. Then what happens?
Yeah. And the sad thing is, the longer Coinbase manages to go unhacked, the bigger the honeypot, the bigger the damage. I mean, to the point where, like, if it's a few years from now, I mean, it's going to happen someday, right? And if it's 5 years from now, 10 years from now, the collateral damage is, you know, exponentially worse than it would be much better to happen today, you know, with the ETFs only in their first year. That now, obviously, for Bitcoin's price, I think people would, you know, freak out and, you can't custody Bitcoin safely. We'd have a lot of the same FUD that we've heard for many years. But the longer they go unhacked, the worse, the bigger the threat becomes, you know?
Yeah, of course.
So of it's, course. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's just so important that people, that people realize what they're buying, you know. I think that's sort of the thing. We don't need, I mean, we're kind of just going off on a tangent here, but like the thing with like MicroStrategy, you know, like you can't scroll, you know, three posts through Twitter without seeing someone talking about Sailor and MicroStrategy. Makes my job really hard for Bitcoin banter finding news. But I think Michael Saylor's a genius. I think he speaks incredibly eloquently about Bitcoin. If I was, you know, more fiat based, I would probably buy a hell of a lot of MicroStrategy stock. What people forget to talk about is the counterparty risk. I mean, Sailor could get hit by a bus. MicroStrategy's core business could begin to fail. I mean, the Bitcoin price could plummet. There are so many things that Coinbase could get hacked. There are so many things that could go wrong. It's just this, I mean, but kind of to circle back to your unpopular opinion of influencers not being, you know, being basically fiat shills and not real Bitcoiners or however you said it. You see so much of that. And I suspect it wasn't like that 10 years ago in Bitcoin. I wasn't around then, but it was, you know, a real cypherpunk mindset. And we're it just as like a community, to the extent you want to think of Bitcoiners as a community. I think we're losing like some of the, what made it what it is. And it was always inevitable, Wall Street and nation states and institutions. But, the more people we can onboard, and it's back to your mission for the Bitcoin way, the more people we can onboard, the sooner, you know, we're just going to live in a much better hyper Bitcoinized world, whatever that means to you. 10, 20 years from now. So,
yeah, I mean, what I'd like to see more of, and what's a little disappointing from what I see, is that a lot of the excitement these days is all around the number go up. Right.
Yeah.
is not about Bitcoin specifically. It's about Bitcoin's number go up. Ex-government is talking about strategic reserves. BlackRock bought X amount of Bitcoins. Michael Saylor bought another 20,000 Bitcoin. It's always about somebody else, what they're doing with Bitcoin. But what about what you're doing for Bitcoin? Like, why are you getting excited about what other people are doing? Focus on you, because what they're doing doesn't benefit you in any way, shape, or form, unless you've bought whatever amount you're comfortable with, and now you're sitting and praying that the big boys just pump your bags. But if you're waiting for them to pump your bags, you're still thinking in dollars and cents. You're not thinking, you know, in the true essence of what it is that you're holding. You know, this is what I find a little disappointment, because everybody's focused on that number go up. Yes, it's great. It's good. Like conversation starters, it's bringing a lot more attention to the space. But it's the most irrelevant thing about Bitcoin, that number go up. So instead of focusing on what other people are doing, what governments are doing and what have you, people should be focused and, you know, genuinely driven to get as much of it as possible while they still can, in the sense that you're still able to go somewhere, buy it, and custody it yourself. When these big boys finish doing what they're doing, and I believe that's going to happen any minute now, the fiat price of Bitcoin will no longer be affordable by almost 99% of people. Already at 100, whatever it is now, a lot of people can't afford one Bitcoin. Now, luckily, you don't have to buy one to benefit. You can buy, you know, as much of it as you want. But even then, when Bitcoin becomes worth tens of millions and billions of dollars, which is exactly what it's going to be worth, you know, in the not so distant future either, then who's going to be buying anything? No one's going to be buying a single Satoshi. The only way 8 billion people benefit from it at that point really is, first of all, not on the on-chain level, on the on-chain layer. That'll be gone. You're not going to be able to buy anything. You know, they'll be benefiting on layer 2, 3 and what have you, and mostly by earning it. You know, like when you go to work, the person's not going to want to be paid in dollars or euros or any of that worthless money. They're like, pay me in sats now. That's all I want. And so that's how they start improving their quality of life. But the days of, you know, waltzing into, you know, wherever and just, yeah, give me 5K worth of Bitcoin or 10K or 100K, whatever they mean, those will be gone. Unless you're sitting on billions of dollars, you're not buying anything. And that's what I think is going to happen very, very soon, even as soon as maybe at the end of this year. But next year, for sure, things go absolutely bananas. When Donald Trump takes office, and if he does like 25% of what he's saying, that on its own will make all the fiat number go up junkies go into hyperdrive.
Lose their minds.
Because, you know, they will see Bitcoin worth $1 million and that's it, man. It's like the 4th of July every single day of the year. So, game theory.
Fasten your seatbelts.
Game theory. Fasten your seatbelts. It's about to go down. But, you know, those that truly understand Bitcoin and the revolution, don't get distracted by this. Like, for me, it's amusing because, you know, people call, they ask about it. Of course, you know, we respond and we inform and all that stuff. But to truly benefit from it all, there's only one way. There's no other way to be part of this revolution if you are not in full control of your keys. No matter what anybody tells you, no matter what anybody says, if you're not holding your keys 100% in custody at all times, you are not holding Bitcoin. Or you're introducing a risk to it, which is silly considering that this is your one-time chance at generational wealth that you will never get again if you lose it due to an inadvertent oversight or mistake.
Yeah. Tony, well said. I think that is a good place to wrap up. But I'd tell you to give a handoff like I do most guests, but I think everyone knows where to find the Bitcoin way. Yeah. And I'll mention us in the outro too. So, man, this was a lot of fun. Thank you so much for taking the time. It's like 7:30 now AM your time. It's 11, almost 11:30 my time. So time for me to get to sleep, time for you to get started.
Hey, and, man, Bitcoin never sleeps, and neither do we.
That's right. All righty, brother. Good talking with you.
Thank you, Michael. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Cheers, man.
Cheers, bro.
And that's a wrap. Again, I appreciate you taking time to listen today. Really appreciate having Tony on the show. His story is incredibly powerful. I know it got heavy at times, but I think it's so important that people really understand what happens when money breaks. And there is no one better to illustrate that for us than Tony. If you like this show, do me a huge favor. Subscribe to the channel. Give us a like, comment, share it with someone. We'd really appreciate any sort of engagement and passing along word of mouth. And of course, if you need help with proper 100% Bitcoin self-custody, we are the people to talk to. Go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. We would love to help you with this. We walk through this process with dozens of people every day. We'd love to have a chance to chat with you and explain how it is that we go about this. We also help with online privacy, privacy phones. We even have a Plan B residency options. So check out thebitcoinway.com/podcast. Again, thank you for tuning in. As always, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.